Again, we welcome each and every one of you to our 23rd Annual Study Day here in Lompoc. I believe Brother Frank has been back. This is his fourth time back, I believe, or fifth time back. He's had quite an adjustment this year. He tells me when he left home, it was minus 4 degrees. And he's still warming up, I think. I'd like to be sure, first of all of you have a set of notes. Is anybody in the room that we didn't get to? Okay. Who will lead us in the first session, I come quickly. What did he mean? Brother Frank.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. It is good to be here. It's warmer. And one of the things that really does sort of make you feel good about coming to a place like this is we haven't been able to grow anything for the last 6 months. And it's nice to know that there is some places warm enough to grow vegetables and things to keep us in food during the wintertime. So we don't expect to see, you know, any growth in our area anyway until the last week in May. So we still got a little while to go. So it is nice to be here again and see the lovely flower gardens and just feel the warmth that you have down here. It seems to be every time I come, it's about this temperature, even in the summer. So it's very nice. I want you to understand you need a set of notes today. This is very critical because everything I'm going to say is in the notes. These are my notes as well. So if you have a set of notes, hopefully you'll be able to follow through, and I'll be telling you where we are. And sometimes get a little bored, you could do a little speed reading and get into the next one, so you know exactly what's coming. A few weeks back, I got a letter from a sister in another ecclesia in somewhere in the North America area, and it sort of reminded me of just what we're facing today. This sister wanted me to look over a letter that had been circulated in their ecclesia. And the essence of the letter was that the Lord will return August 29th, 1997. Now, you may have heard that too, because I understand that letter and that idea is in circulation. And I read over the letter. And all I can say is what I suppose everybody is saying, if we just wish that would be the case. I mean, that's what we've been looking for. That's what we've been waiting for. That's where our hope is, that the Lord will return. But there is a matter of scholarship, and there is a matter of saying, well, why do you feel that? Like, where's the evidence that the Lord will return August 29th this year? And it's essentially based on two things. One is that this happens to be the second, well, will be the second jubilee after the first Jewish Congress in 1897. And you will know that there is, you know, appears to be some substance to the idea, because if you take the first jubilee, it fell in 1947, which was a very significant year. And the other suggestion was that this happens to be the 2000th year since the birth of Christ. Now, from my way of looking, I am not impressed with that scholarship. I don't believe that those things really are as significant as the letter made them out to be. And what's more important is really the substance of this first address, "Behold, I come quickly." It always impressed me that if the Lord was not aware of the day or the hour when he would come back, it could hardly be just as simple a matter of adding 2,000 years to his birth. Surely the Lord would have seen that significance. If the first, you know, Jewish Congress was really the important thing of history, then it seems to me to be a little awkward in terms of Bible passages of where God's dated things and things, you know, very important dates have their sort of their anchor point. So I like to look at this. I found that people sometimes despair, like we've been to the sort of the front where people have thought the Lord must be coming in the next few weeks or maybe the next few days, or, you know, some of these things were so exciting, maybe the next few hours. And as I put the dates in your notes, you know, 1947, 56, 67, 89, 96, all of these years, and maybe there's years in between that have had real significance to us, and possibly some of those dates far more than others. For me personally, 1967 was probably the most exciting of all those dates for me because I happened to be during the time of the Six-Day War giving a series of talks on the Middle East. And putting the radio on before we went to the talks, as you may know, in the first few hours of that Six-Day War, the propaganda was that Israel was gone. The Arabs had wiped it out. It was only after a couple days that we found out the truth about what really had happened. So it was very exciting to be actually speaking on that at the time it was occurring. But nothing's happened. The Lord has not come. And, you know, we may say, well, you know, it doesn't affect me, but I tend to think it affects all of us. That when you get to your expectations come to the top and then nothing happens, and then your expectations rise again and nothing happens, that does take a toll on us. And it's important, I think, to look in our life and to see, you know, how are we reacting to these things? Do we just become numb to it all and don't allow ourselves really to react to anything anymore? Well, the other idea, of course, is, as I put here under point one, is just the idea of so many different ways of looking at prophecy today that people tend to become confused and just don't know what to believe. People have got ideas that, you know, the rush is going to come down and do its work in the Middle East before the Lord ever comes to take us to judgment. I mean, that's one idea that's out there. And of course, the idea that we have believed for many, many years is that the Lord's going to come to us first, take us away first. And that's what's put us on the edge of our seats, because when we saw these things happening, we knew that if we're going to participate, which the Bible speaks of, then surely the Lord has to come to us and take us away. So we go through the process of judgment and the preparation for these events. But if, in fact, we were waiting for some of these things to happen first, that's a very different way of looking at it, quite confusing. And I dare say you would not be nearly as on the edge of your seat. Some people today are not at all sure about the role of the papacy. And we have a whole talk on this because this power is growing immensely in this world, tremendously influential. And being able to see some of the things the scriptures talk about related to it, I think, is just a little alarming as to what might yet transpire for us in this world. So it's, if nothing else, it's exciting, brothers and sisters. It's you've been watching this sort of like a countdown, just seeing the numbers get less and less until we run out of time and the event does happen. That's exciting. And I suppose really all of the exhortations that come out of that will be things we'll think about a little bit, although our talks are not really exhortational. They're more or less, let's look at what the prophecy said and see where we are. Look at the maps. Now, I think every one of us is so familiar with a map that we have the rough idea of when you use a map, why you need a map. But maybe we need to review and review again. The idea is that the only map we have is the scriptures. Like sometimes the way people use present events, you'd almost think that that was the map. That you look around the world, you see what's happening, and then from that you determine where we are in history and what's going to happen. That is not the way we interpret. It's not the way we have inherited from our pioneers how to interpret prophecy. It's to get our Bibles out and to see what the scriptures said would happen. Now, time and again, I'm sure if we open up the pioneer works, you really marvel at what those brethren were able to see. Some people might even think, well, I wonder if John Thomas was really inspired. Like, how could he write these things? Well, you don't go down that direction if you look at what he wrote, because what he wrote was a real careful analysis of what the Bible said would happen. God expects people will read the Bible that way. They won't just listen. They won't just look around, because, you know, it's the faith that we have and what God said that's going to make us righteous before him. It's not what we can see. It's what we believe, what we have looked at and understood and follow. So I put three passages there, which I would think are passages that we want to consider all the time. Whenever we waver a little, or you're just not too sure about this whole idea, what's going to happen? In Amos chapter 3, God has said he will do nothing, but he will reveal his secrets unto his prophets. Now think of the substance of that verse, brothers and sisters. Why would that ever be said? What's God trying to do for us by telling us he will do nothing, but he will reveal his secrets to his prophets? You know, we don't worship God out of fear, in the sense that, you know, we never know what God's going to do. Like the fear of going into a dark room and you're not sure what's there or what's going to confront you. We don't worship God that way. We do fear him because we know what he will do. Our fear is out of our knowledge and understanding of him. But look at the comfort that comes to us from the same kind of a God, of a God who says, look, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Doesn't that give us the desire to try to find out more of what he is going to do? Because the comfort comes from the fact that God doesn't change. When he's instructed us about what he's going to do, it's a matter of us being patient and waiting for it to happen, and looking at what indicates to us that it's about to happen. I guess the other side of that's in Lamentations chapter 3, verse 37, where it says, who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass, when the Lord commanded it not? Like, there's no equal to God in this. That's all bound up in his name, as we've had it expounded to us by our pioneering brethren, that when God speaks and he binds it by his name, it will come to pass. You get that word coming right out of the word Yahweh, that God will do these things. And it's quite instructive in Scripture, when, especially as we've read through the book of Exodus, to see, as God introduced his name, the number of times that you find in the verses that immediately follow, the things he says he will do. And God being faithful, it's just a matter of us seeing when and how, because it will certainly come to pass. And that's Habakkuk for us. The vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come and will not tarry. That's our confidence. So even though we've had expectations that have risen way up, the Lord is coming, and we've become, I suppose, really emotional about it, really involved in these things, and then found out that he didn't come, and we come down again to normal life, and then something else happens. Don't lose heart, brothers and sisters. The vision is yet for an appointed time, says the prophet, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. It's not as if God's put it on sort of permanent delay. We're on a hold, and God's waiting for something to happen that was unexpected, that he didn't foresee. That's not like our God. That's not part of our God. It could not happen that way, because he reveals his secrets to his prophets. He's told us long before these events come to pass how they will happen. Now, I find that comforting, and I do find that very helpful when you're looking at prophecy, to know those things about our God and to remember them, to call them into our memories very often. But there are those parts of his word
that are not easy to just immediately comprehend. And that's why we had Revelation 22 read, because three times in the last chapter, he speaks to the people who are reading and are listening, and he says, I come quickly. Now, if any one of us was to say that to one another, we would probably think that in time they would come quickly. We would probably expect that they'd be returning. We would not expect that if someone said to one of us, or if someone said to us that they were going to come quickly, that we would die first. And that, you know, thousands of years would go by. What did the Lord mean when he said, I come quickly? Because he could not have meant that what would seem to be obvious from it, that he was going to come to the generation which heard those words, returning like people have expected and hoped he would. Well, I don't think it's too difficult to find this if we just have the background of the scriptures to help us. And I've illustrated exactly where you'd look. Isaiah chapter 40, to my mind, is just one of those wonderful things. But it doesn't reveal its message to people who will not think about it. One of the things that I enjoy most about where I live is that we have about a half hour leisurely walk, about a 15-minute good walk to the Ecclesia from our house. And it's totally out in the country. You've got to walk up a road that's a gravel road. And on the sides of the road, there's grass growing. And in the fields, there's cows and hay fields and grain fields. And every time you walk up there, and of course in the summertime, not in the winter, you get the idea of what this verse is all about. Isaiah 40. It's not the only place that God speaks of the same thought. But what a wonderful way. The voice said, cry. And he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. And then again, the grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever. Now, they're beautiful words in their own right. It's just lovely language. But with that in your mind, and giving yourself a 10 to 15 minute walk out in areas where grass is growing and the flowers are coming and going, really strengthens what he's trying to tell us. He's not telling us about the flowers. He's telling us about us. He's saying flesh is like grass. All of us are like the flower of the field. And if the interesting thing about this is that if your walk in that particular path is always a week apart, like you only do this once a week, then the flowers you see one week are not there the next week. Well, they may be there depending on what kind of a flower it is. It maybe has flowers that bloom up a stem or something like that. But generally, the picture really comes to you in a strong way, that God's speaking of flesh, and he's saying we're like the grass of the field. You know, one thing about where we live, you might say, well, an awful place where you're just like living in a big ice box. And largely it is. You can make ice real well for a lot of the year. But when spring comes, it bursts out. You know, when the water starts to run and the snow melts and the warm days come, it just seems as if there is something that triggers everything to just suddenly sprout. And grass that you hadn't seen anything there for months now, in just a week or two, can be up to a foot high. It's amazing, that burst of growth in the spring. But it's not long before, you know, the grass comes to a head, comes to flower, and then you see it wilting and dying. God teaches us every single year that same lesson. And there's some of us who know that some of our closest ones are not with us this year. Because like the grass, and flesh being like grass, and this side of the kingdom, we don't live forever. We've laid them to rest. Every year, some of us will not be with us the next year. Now that's life. And what's it telling us? Well, it's telling us whatever you're going to do, do it with all your might. For there's no work, there's no knowledge, there's no device in the grave where we're going. Does that stir any feelings in you, brothers and sisters? I mean, do those thoughts sort of get the adrenaline going a little? Does that make you want to try to find something to get busy with in the truth? Does it make you want to do something, you know, with more dedication? I mean, what are the words for? Surely they can't just be the fact that, hey, they're going to die like the flowers. No, there's another message in it. The message is that whatever you're going to do, get your mind on it and get busy with it because you don't have all that much time. And everything else in life seems to support that. The very, very busy, busy life that we have in these days. Now, I like to illustrate from Revelation itself that this idea of him coming quickly had a significance about it. In chapter 3 of Revelation, verse 11, he says, "Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown." Now we're going to try to focus the words of exhortation tomorrow on just that thought. Let no man take your crown. What a wonderful thought. When you think of, maybe we hadn't directly thought of it this way, but that's really what life does to us. When you find that things provoke you to thoughts and to actions which are not Christ-like, that's exactly what's happening. If we don't watch that, that can be the means whereby we lose our crown. Sometimes they're based in very simple little things, but they irritate us to the point where we're provoked to do, to think things which just are plain un-Christ-like. And it could be the means of us losing our crown. So that bears some time and some thought all alone. But whenever we're reading this book, like any other book, we must first of all understand it had a meaning and a significance to the very first people that received it. Like our mindset quite often, and good that it is what is it telling me? What can I get out of this? But if we don't first of all think a little about what it meant to the people who first received it, sometimes we get quite mixed up in what it's teaching us. It must have had a significance to the people who first received this, where he says, "Behold, I come quickly, hold that fast which thou hast." Now you try to think of a practical way of looking at that. You know, you're dismantling something, like maybe one of these light fixtures, and you have someone helping you, and you get to the position of where it's just about ready to come down, and you find it's quite heavy. So someone says, "Well, just hold on, I'll go and get something." But how long are you supposed to hold on? See, that's the concept behind it. Hold fast that which thou hast. Now, time becomes really important here because this may be difficult to do. So the idea of the Lord, "Behold, I come quickly," was meant to help us in that situation. We're holding on to something that's difficult to do. And the Lord gives us the assurance, "Look, don't worry, I'm coming quickly." Now, if the Lord was mistaken, it was going to be 2,000 years before he would come, then we got a major problem on our hands. Unless we can understand what he's saying there. Well, let's go a little further. One of the passages that just picks up on the thought we had a few minutes ago was in James chapter 4. Now, we live in a day when we don't have too much in the way of persecution. We certainly don't have our lives threatened for saying what we believe, but that may be because we don't say it enough, and it may get more that way. But in James chapter 4, verses 14, 15, it says, "Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and vanishes away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do that. Now, there's a theme there, brothers and sisters, which is worth following through in one study. It occurs in so many little different ways. It's not something you could probably just, you know, find a phrase and search it through that way. You might have to do it differently. But the idea behind it is how God considers some things that we consider really long and hard to endure as being very tiny and almost of no consequence. You sort of think, well, you know, does God really understand? Well, we know he understands. We know he understands because of the sufferings of our Lord. So we don't really have to go down that road too long. But God's always trying to tell us that our suffering, our period of suffering, is just a tiny little bit of time compared to the glory, endless glory, that shall be revealed. It's beyond our mind to comprehend anything that's unending, that never ends. Can't really comprehend what living forever is like. Our mind just doesn't allow us to understand something that doesn't end, doesn't allow us to understand something that doesn't have a beginning either. We work with those limitations at this present time. But God's trying to tell us that anything we endure is just a small, little, almost inconsequential thing compared to what he's going to reveal to us in the day of the coming of his Son. So in verse 14 of chapter 4 of James, our life is like a vapor. Now, we probably see that as often as anybody in history would have seen it, because whenever we turn our kettle on, we see a little vapor. And we know it does occur for a very little time. It's gone. Why does God use something like that to tell us that's what our life is like?
Or is God aware of our minds? And he knows that one of the problems that we face as humans is not taking that argument seriously enough. As to thinking, oh, we got tomorrow. That's the whole problem of procrastination, which we all are procrastinators. I'll do it tomorrow. But how do you know you have tomorrow to do it? How do you know that tomorrow will not have so many problems that you can't do it? We found that out sometimes, that's why we shouldn't procrastinate. But you see, God's zeroing in on a problem we have. And he's trying to tell us something about our life. If your life is really like a vapor, then you better get down to deciding what you're doing with it quick. And get at it quick, lest you be robbed of the opportunity to do anything about life or do anything in life. I think that's a wonderful, it's a basic exhortation. If something like that can't get us off our seat and do something, I don't know what can. I mean, if God speaking to us doesn't make us jump, then what will? And those little prods are remind us what life is like. As the psalmist says, in that very day, his thoughts perish. There's limitations, brothers and sisters. So, you know, the whole other side of being impatient, when's the Lord going to come, is, you know, I'm working with a few people, and I just hope we can bring it to fruition. It's a whole other side to the waiting for the Lord. If we're out there busy with this tool that God's allowed us to develop and to have, these seminars, they're just wonderful things in the way they're working. Then you're busy with people, and you're just hoping these people will come to a full understanding and can be baptized before the Lord comes. And you look at it totally different, rather than being impatient, like, when's he coming? It's almost as if, you know, one point it's a totally selfish way of looking at it. Another one is totally unselfish. And we in Shelburne have just been totally impressed with the power of these seminars. We've just had 4 baptisms from the seminars. We've never had, you know, hardly any response to anything. We'd try to get anybody out to anything is people almost considered a miracle for someone to walk in, but the seminars, we've had no trouble getting people to come. We've had no trouble getting people to stay, and every seminar we've had has produced somebody who has taken it seriously enough to follow up classes. And to say we've had 4, we're looking at the 5th. Now, with that kind of work going on and that work to do, then maybe that's where we should be concentrating our thoughts, based on how little time we have, is to get with it and accomplish the things that God expects us. Oh, we're turning the page. We got 10 minutes. This is going to happen time and again today, I can see. Now, another whole area to consider is this idea, I come as a thief. He's coming quickly, for sure. With what we have to do, and because of our life, he is coming very quickly. But he also is going to come to us as a thief to some. Revelation chapter 3, verse 3 is an excellent verse to give us the concept behind this, because it had an immediate sense. He's talking to the members of the ecclesia in Sardis. And he says in verse 3, remember therefore how thou hast received and heard, and hold fast and repent. If therefore thou shalt not watch, I will come on thee as the thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I will come upon thee. Now the help, brethren and sisters, is to think of that in its immediate context. Like this had an immediate context for the people at Sardis. They've got this letter, and the Lord had said things that maybe they weren't expecting to hear, but they were severe words. If you won't watch, I will come upon thee as a thief. So in some way, in their lifetime, they were a unique group of people. The Lord was going to come as a thief if they would not watch. Now, I expect, as you may very well have thought it through as well, that the way the Lord would have come would not have been in any personal sense. He didn't come to them personally to talk to them or to judge them. But if they happen to die in an unexpected way, and I suppose that everybody does, even though we might know we have a terminal disease or something and we expect to die, when we die, it's unexpected. And what we can learn from people dying is that there may be quite a lengthy period of time prior to someone dying when they're incapacitated. This is just one of the aspects of our modern society. I really find it a little hard to think through. And my grandmother, before she died, was very sick. My grandmother was a very sincere, sober-minded person all her life. That's the only way I remember my grandmother. But when she was very sick and prior to her death, the drug she was getting was causing her to hallucinate and to be a totally different person than I ever knew her. She was talking about people in the cupboard, and they had fears about things that she never experienced in her life. It was purely the drugs and their effect on her mind. Other people, I remember talking to a brother and trying to get him to change his mind on something. And while he was alive and well, he obviously was able to think it through, but he did get to the point where he was so sick he could no longer think. And he didn't die right away, but he went through this period of sickness where he just couldn't think anymore. He was robbed of the opportunity of doing anything. So that is another way. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be the day of our death, but we can be robbed of the opportunity if we don't recognize what he says when he mentions to people in difficulty, I come as a thief. Surely that day when we stand before him is a day we ought to think about very much prior to coming. And I just wanted to make the second note there too. It's just a... In your notes, note 2, it just amplifies the same point. Now, the parable of the Lord, man who couldn't decide what to do with all his goods while he was going to tear his barns down and build greater. He didn't understand, or he didn't think enough about the idea that the Lord may come and all his ambitions would come to an end. That little quotation at the end there, Luke 21, 34 to 36, I think contains the message for us, because it talks about our hearts being overcharged with surfeiting and the cares of this life. And to a large extent, the pace of life and the demands of life just carry us along like we're on the crest of a wave, and we've sort of lost control. We're there. We're just going with it all. But the Lord expects us to be in control. And that's something quite difficult to do. We'll talk a little more about that, Lord willing, in our classes. I just would like, though, to make this last point in Ezekiel 33. This point, to my mind, is very stimulating. We just turn to that record, Ezekiel 33, verse 12. Now, this is the chapter of the watchman. And we may know this chapter for any one of a number of things which almost uniquely come from the chapter. Ezekiel 33. But what I want to concentrate on is verse 12, and just reading down a few verses from that. Let's read there from Ezekiel 33, verse 12. Therefore, thou son of man, say unto the children of thy people, the righteousness of the righteous shall not deliver him in the day of his wickedness, or the day of his transgression. As for the wickedness of the wicked, he shall not fall thereby in the day that he turneth from his wickedness. Neither shall the righteous be able to live for his righteousness in the day that he sinneth. When I shall say to the righteous that he shall surely live, if he trust to his own righteousness and commit iniquity, all his righteousnesses shall not be remembered, but for his iniquity that he hath committed, he shall die for it. Again, when I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, if he turn from his sin and do that which is lawful and right, if the wicked restore the pledge, give again that he hath robbed, walk in the statutes of life without committing iniquity, he shall surely live, he shall not die. None of his sins that he hath committed shall be mentioned unto him. He hath done right, or he hath done that which is lawful and right, he shall surely live. Would any of us argue with that? I'm sure we'd all say, well, that's righteous. That's just for God to do that. But boy, let's listen to what that's saying. We would probably listen most carefully to the righteous side of that. It only stands to reason. It's people who are in any other position who would be listening to the other side. But look at this righteous side. It's saying that if a person forsakes his righteousness, then God's not going to treat this as a balance. I'm sure we understand that. We can't say, well, we served the Lord for 20 years. Doesn't that offset 1 year of leave of absence? No, it doesn't, because God doesn't weigh it that way. It's not just a simple balance weigh. He's saying, look, you would have to lose your integrity to take a sabbatical from God and say, well, I'm going to take a year and I'm going to follow my own interests. And hence, it's based on our conscience. It's based on and how we've looked at life and our basic concepts of life that God judges us, our motives for life. Well, think about it, brothers and sisters. If, occasionally we have to make decisions in an ecclesia about someone who has done that as a member of the ecclesia. And we find the person isn't attending the classes. What do we do about it? And, some ecclesias may have a clause written in their constitution. If you're away any more than so many weeks, you're visited. And, because that's one of the things that people have to do is to attend and to be a member, an active member of an ecclesia. Other ecclesias may not have that written in, and things go on for months, go on for years. But would any of us dispute that God is righteous, that for a person who has abandoned all his righteousness and gone off for a year to live his own or her own lifestyle, that God would be just in following this through, saying, well, you've abandoned it for a whole year. Therefore, I'll judge you for your present way of thinking, which is wrong and false. Would we object to that? Wouldn't that be reasonable? For God to say that, the person has left this for a whole year. Well, let's just back it up, brothers and sisters. It's a very simple process. And try to think in your mind what makes the difference. If a person has left the truth and abandon what they think and have believed all their life is righteous for a month, would God be right and judging them for it? That's a whole month. You get a lot of time in a month to think things through. How about a week? Do you think that people can take a sabbatical from God for a week? Say, I'm not going to remember the righteous ties I have, and I'm just going to go out and do what I like for a week? You see, we're talking about something that's a conscious, willing decision of the mind. And if it happens for a year or a month or a week, what's the difference? You keep backing up and say, can you do this for a day? Can you say one day of the week that, all right, I'm going to, you know, be righteous and follow these teachings for 6 days, but on the seventh day, I'm going to take a day off? I don't think any of us would reason that way. You really can't reason to take any time off until we come back to our Lord, who didn't take any time off. He didn't ever take a minute off from his service of his God and was able to maintain righteousness throughout his life. Now, what are we doing? What are those people associated with us doing? How do we measure righteousness? Do we, you know, are we governed by what God has given us as the standard here, or somehow or other sort of thinking in our mind that it's a weigh scale way of doing it? God never gives us any indication that that's the way he measures things. Really, I come quickly, as the Lord said three times, is to deal with a human problem that we have. We will probably think that we have time yet to do things that ought to be done. It's this whole area of procrastination, of not being serious enough about what we're really up to in the truth and the work of the truth. I can only say that in my experience, and I'm sure there's other people have other experiences and maybe even better, but in my experience, one of the best things to be doing is the work of the truth, because it just sort of pulls you on to be immersed in it, to find something, some means to be immersed in it. And it seems that with the opening up of the seminars, that people have got work that they didn't ever realize. I mean, it's not only the presenters. When we've presented, we've always taken three brethren and three sisters. I always tried to be a husband-wife team so that you convey to people out there that what we consider about the family. And then found that, you know, certain of the people who have come to the seminar have sort of got close to at least one of the six people. And it may be a sister. And we if it's a female and it's a sister, we just allow that to work as long as it will until someone else is needed. And a brother with a man. But quite often that's not the way it starts. And some of the female attendees, it's the last thing would ever do is go and ask a woman. They only want to identify with the men, and vice versa. But it's given everybody some work to do. And then those classes, every one of our contacts has had classes for at least a year afterwards. And that's a dedication on our part to get out there and to work with these people and answer their difficult questions, deal with the problems that they have in their life. And that work of the truth just takes this whole picture into another category altogether, where you're just hoping that the Lord won't come before they're baptized. You know, your certainty doesn't give you any license to do anything wrong. It's just that you just wish, it's like your own children who are not yet baptized, that the Lord would work in their life, that something would happen, that before he comes, they might be with us. Now, these are the things that really make us happy and live in the spirit of I come quickly. Now, our next talk is going to start into something which is central to Christadelphian thinking. We have anything to look for or have looked for that was stronger than the position of Israel. And I'm just going to take a little bit of time and talk about this, because we're going to need more than the time in the second class to get through it. So let's just start on page 3 of your notes. The whole idea of bringing the idea of a map to this study was just, when I was thinking about these things, I happened to be going somewhere, and I thought I knew where I was. I was driving along the road that I was supposed to be on, and then the next time I looked up, this was no longer the road. And I had no idea what happened. Like, it wasn't the highway I was on just a few minutes ago, and I never turned off, so I couldn't figure out what had happened. And I thought, well, that's what happens when we're lost. You just suddenly look up, or you suddenly feel, I don't know where I'm going. No, I'm lost. Someone tell me where I am. So I found it was really quite interesting to try to be sure of where I was, because I was actually driving in an area I had never been in my life. Totally new area. So I got out my map, and I guess the only thing I could do is just keep driving a bit till I found something that was on the map. You had to find a location somewhere that's on that map. And even then, when I found the location, I was in this town. I wasn't too sure whether I was going north, south, east, or west. So I had to continue going to find another point so I could be sure which way I was going. I thought, well, that is really quite interesting, because really, in the scriptures, just finding one contact point doesn't tell you all that much. You really need two. I'm going to try to show that in a number of the areas we're looking at, that we need not only to know where we are in terms of time and in the whole picture of prophecy, but we need to know maybe some other point of this is clearly indicated in the scriptures, what we expected. We've been there, so we know that. Here's another thing that's happening, so we know our direction and we know where we are. And that's the greatest area of comfort. So now we're going in the right direction, and we know exactly where we are. Well, that's what we'd like to do prophetically. With the scriptures in hand, and with the people of Israel, I'd say we are in just the most blessed position. I mean, every day, and it's been this way for a good long time now, every day you can find something significant in the news about the people of Israel. You turn on, if you got access to the internet, and you look at the main headlines, they're making headlines around the world, and everybody's got access to this, you almost every single day will see an article about the Jews or about Israel somewhere in there. It's just as if God's saying, I'm going to direct the people's attention to these people if they will just start thinking about what this means. Now, I think that's our purpose in life, brothers and sisters. I mean, if you think through what it means to be the salt of the earth, when do you use salt? Yeah, you reach, well, some people, you know, sort of have a habit for it, and some people have just the opposite. They'll never reach for it. But in the average case, we would reach for salt when we want to accentuate the flavor, bring out a flavor, or something hasn't got the flavor. Now, isn't that what we're all about? There's a whole realm of people out there who also witness these events, but they have no sense of the flavor. They don't know what it means. There's no significance to them. The significance is understanding God's word and then seeing what's happening. So when he says this one, a very appropriate passage, which we see in our pioneers and almost everybody else that's written on Israel, Isaiah 43, verse 10. Ye are my witnesses, and you witness that I am God. That's what they witness to. They witness that God is God. They witness that God's plan is worked out, that he is reliable. What he says will come to pass. The Jews are his witness. And what's so significant about their witness is God doesn't depend upon them being willing witnesses. I suppose for those people who consider themselves Jehovah's Witnesses, that's one of the major points, is that the people that God says are my witnesses witness whether they want to or not, and have done so ever since the passage was written. So if they chose not to follow God, they fulfilled the promises that said that. If they chose to follow God as they did for a little, then they fulfilled those promises. Either way, they show that God is God. He can tell. He can write, cause to be written, rather, what will happen in the future. There is a uniqueness about his people, Israel. Now, I'm going to stop it there, and we'll take a little extra time maybe for a break, because that probably would be a little advisable for everybody in the first time anyway. And we'll pick up on this idea of Israel. If anyone thinks they know all this, you can take a break in the second one. It's all there, what I'm going to say. But I don't think we would, because I really believe that some of the most exciting things that we find in the scriptures are what relates to Israel. Beyond, it seems to be, any shadow of doubt, it would be what we consider, as we're looking for, proof that we are on the right track by looking at what the scriptures said would happen with those people and then seeing what in fact is occurring in our life.